Welcome to another episode of Fulbright Forward, a diversity podcast. My name is Jeremy Gommon-Sperling, the Fulbright Diversity and Inclusion Liaison for the Western Hemisphere programs. Today's episode of the podcast is number 5 from the Western Hemisphere region and the second of 2 episodes focused on unpacking English and language teaching. In this episode, we speak with Mei-Ling Chong, a bilingual Spanish-English educator currently in Boston, Massachusetts, and also a former English teaching assistant in La Mana, Ecuador, where she taught from 2017 to 2018. A key theme of my conversation with Mei-Ling is the phrase and idea, I refuse to choose. Now, the phrase itself, as we discussed in this episode, comes from a book by Barbara Shore with the same name, Refuse to Choose. In the book, Shore encourages her readers to not suppress one passion over the other in pursuing their career, but rather to follow a path that allows all of our interests to be part of our lives. Mei-Ling, however, brings the meaning of this phrase to important and critical places, in particular as an engine for greater inclusion and support for multiracial, multicultural, and multilingual people. As Mei-Ling notes from her own experience as a biracial Latina woman of Chinese and Peruvian heritage, who immigrated from Peru to the U.S. at a young age, she has experienced many moments where the world around her either has tried to force her to compress or hide the abundance of her identities, or force the same on others who hold similar identities and lived experiences. Refusing to choose, therefore, in this context and for Mei-Ling, is more than an embrace of one's passions, but rather a declaration to the world that we will not hide the complexity of who we are for the comfort of others, or even to fit what social orders and hierarchies assume us to be or tell us to be. As Mei-Ling will discuss, this is about breaking assumptions abroad that the only people who can claim to be from the United States and or teach English are white, or as she has done in her teaching, fostering spaces where young children raised in a language and are culture different from the dominant one can celebrate and be celebrated for the many languages and cultures they bring, that they are very much more than enough. Refuse to choose is therefore a call to upset power, and in today's episode, that means a conversation on identity, English teaching, and the impact of whiteness in the Western Hemisphere. Mei-Ling, it's great to have you here. Welcome so much to the podcast. Welcome so much to Fulbright Forward.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. It's really nice to be here.
So with our episodes, we usually like to start with a pretty simple question, just to get to know a little bit more about you. So if you could just tell us more about who Mei-Ling is, your background, and just who you are.
Sure. So my name is Mei-Ling Chong, and I am a bilingual, biracial, multicultural immigrant from Peru. I immigrated in 2002, and I actually am Peruvian Chinese. I graduated from Wheelock College in 2017 with a bachelor's in psychology. College was really interesting because not only did we have to have an actual bachelor's degree, but also a professional career. So I also got my Massachusetts teaching license in early childhood education. So I came out with like 2 careers there. Then after that, I actually did my Fulbright. And when I was about to come back, I was like, well, let me invest in more schooling, apparently. So I actually went to UPenn, University of Pennsylvania, for my MSED in International Education Development. As you can see, my life is pretty much like a mixture of all interests and identities. For me, it's really hard to choose one path. And it's always been difficult to just like find one passion. And so instead, I choose them all. And I actually like to reference I Refuse to Choose, that book. I just really believe that everyone has different passions and different spectrums, and it's good to pursue them. So that's me in a nutshell.
What brought you to pursue an English teaching assistant post, an ETA ship in Ecuador? And what were your goals, intentions, and applying?
Yeah, so it was very, very, very complex, actually. So I'm a first generation college student, first person to ever explore a college or higher ed. And that was very difficult at Wheelock. So luckily, I'm very, very fortunate. I actually found a really important mentor in my life. His name is Dr. Adrian Hagerbrook. He showed me different things, like different experiences that I could take on at Wheelock, post-Wheelock. He even told me about a master's, which I was like, what the heck is a master's? So I was very much, very, very lucky to have that mentor. And junior year, so in 2016, I actually, we had our weekly or monthly check-ins, and I was sitting in the dining hall with him, and I remember him saying, or asking me, like, what are you going to do next year after you graduate? And I was like, I don't know. And I think back then I was very much always a planner. Like, I had to have like a plan A through like Z, because I always feared of not knowing what would come next. But when he asked me, I was so lost, because I was like, well, I could do teaching, I could do city year, I could do et cetera. And then he was like, wait a second, how about you try one of these grants? And he showed me Rhodes Scholars, Fulbright. He showed me like a lot of different grants that I had no idea. For me, when he first told me about it, it was very much like an alternative. Like, I didn't really think of it as like, that's what I wanted to do, because of the competition, actually. So I feared that competition, since it's so, so prestige, right? As silly as it sounds, I think I didn't really know what I was getting myself into. So I was just like, let's just go. Like, whatever happens, happens. But I think my goals changed every month. No joke. I think when I was like introduced to it, I was like, oh yeah, like I want to do this for myself, because this is such like another accomplishment that I could get. And then when I started the application process and saw how intense it was, I was like, okay, why am I really doing this? And at that moment, I think it was like, okay, this is going to be a good experience. Like, the application process, understanding like these really intense application process for jobs, for like later just experiences that I will have. And then while I had to write my personal statement, I realized that I was thinking really big, and that I was so naive to like everything that could come. So I was like so centered around this idea of, well, this is going to be life-changing, not only for you, but for them. When I received that letter that said I got it, I was like, wait a second, like, this is bigger than me. This is bigger than what I thought my intentions were. Now I really need to buckle down and really understand and have realistic expectations and intentions for myself. So I knew that I wasn't going to be changing lives, and that I was going to be making massive changes. But instead, I think my main goal right before I left actually to go to Ecuador was to create ripple effects in perspective, whatever that meant, cultural, racial, anything, any perspective, which will inherently then change mine, right? So I saw it more of that cultural exchange, and that Fulbright really highlights in their program.
So before we go into any sort of other questions, just to give folks context listening to the podcast, like, take us to where you were in Ecuador, like the town, the school, the population, the community, if you could just like, in your words or your experience, like provide kind of that context for where you were throughout your grant.
I went to a small town called La Maná. La Maná is in the valley. So it's legit 3 hours from Latacunga, que está en la sierra, and 2 hours from the coastline. So I was in the middle of both environments, which created this really, really humid environment, which I was so not used to. So that was a big shock, coming in from like the freezing cold sierra. And then all of a sudden, like, I was like, wow, it's so hot. But very, very, very knit, like tight-knit community. There was one university there, and it was actually an extension. So the main Universidad Técnica de Cotopaxi is in Latacunga, Ecuador. And the extension, one of the extensions, is in La Maná. Because it was legit a college community, basically, everyone knew each other. It was really hard to go somewhere without like people being like, oh, I know your mom. And I'm like, wow, okay. Yeah, it was a very, very small community. It was very difficult for me, from coming from a city, to go into a small town. It was very, I think the cultural shock that I received was not like the Spanish, the Hispanic, was more of like context of of community. Like, I hadn't been in a small community in a really long time, and it just shocked me that, like, I couldn't go anywhere without, like, people being like, oh, hola, ¿cómo estás? Hola, Maylene. And I was like, okay, please stop. I was like, overload. So that took a while to get used to. The weather really impacted my health, actually, my mental health, because I'm not a hot, like a humid, hot person. Like, I really just like the cold. And because it was so small and close to the Andes, I was actually able to explore a lot of Quechua community. I was very immersed into that. A lot of my students were actually from Quechua background. And that was just amazing for me. I was able to explore a whole new culture within the mestizo communities, right? And that was just like a nice little gift that I got, especially linguistically. So
what was it like for you just navigating your identities while in Ecuador? I mean, and really thinking just in particular about, if you want to talk about anyone in particular that sort of stands out for you, but really just want to understand more of, like, what was it like for you just sort of navigating a culture and community that in some ways felt familiar to you, and as you named, also had these nuances and differences, and also was a new role, being a teacher, being part of, also in some ways kind of becoming part of a community, even if just for a year or so. So just very curious what it was like for you just to navigate Maylene in this sort of similar yet different context and place.
Well, first, I think I want to go down the route that no one really prepared me for this, and me as in a person of color. My identity, I have never really settled, and I still grapple with understanding who I am, that for sure. And that root really just affects my positionality within every context, because I think it was after Fulbright that I really started to understand who I am and started to love who I am. No one really prepared me to understand what others thought of Americans, right? As like a nationality, people coming from America, how shocking that reverse culture shock is for them to not see a white American. Yeah, I was not prepared for that, for just all the experiences that I had in Ecuador. From my perspective, as the Peruana that I identify more with, I was so elated being in Ecuador. I was like, oh, están hablando español. I am able to eat certain foods. Like, qué chévere, ¿no? Estaba como que, yeah, finally. Being stuck in Boston sometimes is just very overwhelming with like the, just the city and the lack of Hispanics here. So, sí, estaba bien feliz. But unfortunately, something you can't really see in this podcast is that I'm not visibly what people would identify as Hispanic or Peruvian, right? What people see is the Asian in me. And that is what was extremely difficult and complex to manage in Ecuador. The fact that they were expecting this white American, which actually is what this La Maná had for the 2 years before I was there, all three Fulbright ETAs were white Americans. I actually remember the first day I walked in and the professor introduced me. I remember him saying, like, en esta va a ser nuestra Fulbright ETA. Por favor, like, welcome her. And everyone's face was like, she is going to be teaching us English? And I was like, wait, what? I was so shocked. I was like, why can't I teach English? So that first day was a really like a slap in the face. Like, okay, they were not expecting me to come here. And from that day on, actually, there was a lot of rude comments, microexpressions, jokes, misconceptions that were extremely hard to right, or even make that ripple of change in perspective. Not only was it my Asian identity and my Hispanic background, but also the immigrant. Once I told them that I was an immigrant in the United States, that I immigrated from Peru, it was less valid. Like, they did not see me as someone that could actually teach them English. And they doubted a lot of my ability to teach them. They always asked me, are you sure that's how you say it? Or like, should we like look up a video instead? And yeah, that was really hard. I think it was after they really got to know me and who I was that they were able to be comfortable with me teaching them. Also, being a female was pretty hard in a small community. I think the culture itself of the machismo and piropos that are okay, and that was very, very tough to navigate too. Being that Chinese female really puts me in this like exotic, which I hate that word, but in that exotic, I guess, perspective in their mind, right? So that was the most hardest personal dilemma that I had. But yeah, I really don't think, and talking to other Fulbrighters who are also people of color, I really don't think that we were prepared. We were told that what they were expecting was white Americans, and these like systemic waves of stress that we all like got, where we weren't really supported when we talked about it. Because I think all three of us, all three Fulbrighters of color, were very vocal about it, and that like we really felt not in place. So my Latin American culture was definitely not seen.
I first want to say how much I appreciate you sharing that, because I'm sure it sounds like it brings you back to a time, of course. It sounds like you had a lot of really wonderful experience, but also like pain, hurt, navigating mm-hmm. things, questioning who you are. So what for you were either strategies or ways that you found to support yourself and to, you know, to build a community that, you know, allowed you to show up in your fullness?
That's a really great question. And I don't think I had strategies at first. I think, or maybe I did have a strategy, but maybe not like really self-care. But my mom always says, like, siempre sé terca, Maylin, porque las tercas agarran lo que quieren, no? And to just like quickly kind of interpret that is like always be stubborn, no? Like, if you're stubborn, then something will get done. I think that's what I was trying to do. Good stubbornness. There you go. But yeah, so that's what I was trying to do. I think with every micro expression that I received, like, ay, chinita, ven aquí, or like, oh, like, que china, da da da, all these china, china, china. I think that's the word that I heard the most in the like month that I was there. With everyone that came, I started to get really angry with myself, because I think I've always had difficulty accepting that I'm Asian because of all of these racist comments that I've been confronted with since I immigrated to the US. Because Latin America has this like invisible racism, right? But like, there is racism. And my dad always experienced racism in Peru. Pero it was very like accepted, I guess that's a word, right? Like, if someone called you chinito, that's a form of endearment. When I was like told all these jokes and micro expressions in Ecuador, I was like, no, maybe se terca. Like you can talk to them about this. Like say something that will change their perspective, or they'll open their perspective, and that it's okay to be biracial, and explain to them like your struggles, like growing up in Peru, moving on, da da da. But then after I realized that solely me was not able to change that thought right away, or at least in that year that I was there, and I finally accepted that it was going to take more than just me, I just took them and let it slide. I guess this is where the self-care came in, where I started to make a community for my own of Fulbrighters and really people that I cared about in La Mana. And I was able to just reflect, right? And write stuff down and share about these experiences with the other Fulbrighters of color. And I think that was my biggest mental health strategy, to write everything out, to document it. And I think that just made me a stronger person. And like I mentioned before, because of Ecuador, I now am like happier with who I am as a multicultural, multilingual self. So I'm grateful, and this sounds like kind of silly, but I'm grateful for all of those painful times, because I now am more comfortable with myself. And I look at myself and I'm like, yeah, bueno, sí, soy China. Okay. Like, I love it. So yeah, I think those were my self-care, which I should have done more for myself. But I think it was very difficult trying to navigate everything and think of what to do for myself. So yeah.
I think about a lot with programs is, you know, it's always going to be impossible to eliminate every moment of discomfort, lack of safety, even sometimes, and even, mm-hmm. you know, microaggressive behavior. And we have a responsibility, I'm speaking about programs, to ensure that folks are best supported to best navigate those situations, you know? So mm-hmm. I think that's something I think about just even with your story, that it's like appreciating what you learn at the same time being like, there could have also been much more done.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think now that you bring that up, it's more of like Latinos and Latinx, right, communities, there's no look for us. And I strongly believe that. I really think that mestizos tend to be the ones who are like, if you look at a mestizo, you're like, yeah, Latino, right? Or Latinx. Pero no, I think it's really hard to pinpoint a Latino and a Latinx, Latina, et cetera. And I think that is what hasn't come into conversation, into dialogue, that is missing. Once that is like really poked at and explored, I really think that like there's going to be a lot more, just a lot more acceptance, a lot more of like realizing that this has always been our culture and in our identities. Like there's been so many historical events that have made Latinx who they are. The fact that more of me are being born, I think, is the important. Like more biracial, more mixed, more multiracial children are being born every single time. I mean, in my classroom, I have 4 children who are biracial. When I was in school, I was the only one who was biracial. I think that shift, as an educator, that's my main goal. Once I am able to accept and talk about these and both, I will then open up the space for these children who are growing up in a more, I guess, open to discussion environment than I have. Having to navigate that myself and not belonging right now to any group that I choose to be because I'm not enough, that I don't want that to happen to the children that I'm teaching right now, that they can't be Black enough, they can't be white enough, they can't be Italian enough, they can't be whatever, multilingual enough, because they mix up their languages, etc. So that I think that that's the biggest thing that I am grappling with myself and that I can deal with, but I don't want the same struggles that I have been through to be as intense for the younger generations.
I'm curious about all this stuff with language because I'd love to know more about you as your bilingual teacher self. So what for you does bilingual education mean to you as a teacher and as a person?
I came to the U.S. and I was what we in the research field called sink or swim English education, right? So like I was literally thrown into a first grade classroom. And I can tell you that I hated it. I cried every single day. I did not want to go to school. And that was very traumatic. And I think that's another reason why I don't necessarily love teaching English to foreign countries, which is something I forgot to mention. But going into the Fulbright ETA was tough for me linguistically because of what I just said. I applied to an ETA, but I was like, oh, I'm going against everything I believe in. You know, like I'm going against that, like power that English has, the one that like completely threw me off and affected my family dynamics, affected my like socioeconomic status, like it affected everything, right? Y ese privilegio, ¿no? El privilegio yes. que trae porque, like, mis padres didn't have that privilege. Right. They're so hardworking. They're so intelligent. They are so resilient. Pero el inglés, that's what, like, was so difficult, right? They came mm-hmm. to a new country, had no idea how to speak English, what, like, what to do, and they didn't have a choice. They didn't have yeah. a choice, like many, you know, monolingual, like English speakers who are like, yep, I'm going to find English everywhere. It's like, great, great for you. Pero yeah. most of the world comes and they're lost because it's not a language they're familiar with. So ese privilegio is something that I guess that's what is rooted within me, that I don't want to continue like fostering this English yeah. power. And I'm like, let's do other things. So to me, bilingual education is a form of empowering, if done right, form of empowering the target language group, not necessarily racial, right? Because just because someone speaks Spanish at home does not mean they're Hispanic. So empowering those students more than giving that elite bilingualism to the white children. So that is my personal goal as a bilingual educator, that I want to give that voice and that, not voice, sorry, I'm going to go back. I want to give that space to have them use their own voice in empowering themselves in this English dominant society that we have.
I think it's amazing. And I think it's something that we need. If, again, the goals are things of inclusion, of racial equity, of linguistic equity, there's a lot that needs to be done. You know, as a white person, to acknowledge that whiteness does transcend borders, that whiteness mm-hmm. has these sort of impacts, even just what you just named, right? That like bilingual education, not as a way further add opportunity and asset just to white children, but rather as a community tool mm-hmm. and a community
yeah.
practice. So just curious if there's anything you'd like to say mm-hmm. more just on this concept of how, and maybe this, how whiteness really intersects with these educational experiences you've had. And also about, I think, what I would say is education as a tool for social justice or social change, how mm-hmm. whiteness can actually hurt that possibility.
It's really hard. I'm not sure how to manage this yet, as I am only a first year, like, official teacher. How to make sure that my Latinx children don't fall behind, even in a place where they are supposed to shine. Because of the power that comes with English, the power that comes with whiteness in that setting. The children may not necessarily see it, or they may see it, but not necessarily label it, right? They may not be like, oh, los blanquitos like are getting more attention, are reading faster. It may be over their heads and labeling it, but they see it. And I was just talking to my partner teacher about this, that we're doing a little like show and we're putting on the song Color Esperanza. I don't know if you know that song, but Color Esperanza, I don't remember the song there, but a lot of families.
We'll link the song no matter what.
Yeah, so. we'll do it. Oh, Diego Torres. There we go. Diego Torres. And this is a really old song. This is a really important story that we were talking about, because these Hispanic and Latinx children, once they heard that song, Jeremy, they were like, oh, mi familia sabe esa canción. Nosotros la cantamos, Miss Maylene. And they were so happy, Jeremy. They were dancing salsa. They were just living their culture in this Boston, like very white community, the South End. I was like so happy to hear that. And you could see that the other children weren't put in this position of uncomfortableness. They were like, oh, I don't know this song. Like, what is this? Like, why am I listening to this? You know, that right there was one of the best moments in my career so far, where I saw that these Latinx children were able to boom, like, full themselves with energy, grab these white children, start dancing with them, teaching them what their culture is all about, a little piece of who they are. And now you walk into the classroom, put that song in, everyone is singing it. Everyone's learning the song. Everyone's learning how to salsa. We're learning the importance of what the song means. That is a little piece of like what I would love to see more of in later on, like when I'm teaching down the line or in just in the world, right? And not in putting these like white children in these spaces of uncomfortableness so that they can learn more and have more respect, because that is what's missing, the respect of cultures. They are so young that they see this as an experience, right? They're so young that they're like, oh, sí, tengo compañeros que son Latinx, great, chévere. But those moments where they are uncomfortable, where they're like struggling to learn the language, those are the moments that I want to see more of. And yeah. and to see the Latinx children just like be so happy about learning. And yeah, so I don't know if you know this, Jeremy, but bilingual education in the US was like illegal. And we weren't able to have these spaces where you can speak a different language besides English. So now that they're like kind of re-coming back and really settling down, yet without a lot of resources. Like I have to translate a lot of stuff, right? And translating that is another example of whiteness because and English power, because we're taking these like white culture ideas and just like, oh yeah, we're translating because we don't have enough time, we don't have enough resources. So that in itself is a little disappointing because we're not giving, again, that space for that voice, for that authentic text, for that authentic cultural share. And instead we're labeling it as bilingual education, whereas it's more of like, yep, we're really struggling to teach you Spanish, all of you, and really trying to empower with the little resources we have. It's very interesting to see bilingual education here, bilingual education in other countries, and try to understand that even though bilingual education is seen as a great thing, a lot of the times bilingual education is masked by these really, like I said, really interesting policies that favor one or the other.
Yes.
Like groups, right? If you go to like Puno, Peru, the Quechua, Spanish bilingual education is interesting in itself because although they want to revive and revitalize this beautiful language, it's still grounded within that. Oh, yes, we can do that, but we still need to give them that Spanish. And they don't really realize that it's okay. It's okay to not speak Spanish. Yeah. Obviously, like there's pros and cons to learning and leaving a language behind, but these languages that carry power like Spanish in Latin America or English in the whole world, like it doesn't give space for others to really make those languages as powerful as English, right? And I think this is like a cyclical effect. Like we keep saying there's no text in Quechua. There's no text in Spanish. There's no resources in Spanish for blah, blah, blah. Well, why? Hello? It's because we're not giving that academic Spanish, that academic Quechua enough power to then give text to then provide these resources. So it's going to be like a cyclical thing that we're going through. And until we give those power, that power to those languages, and then those texts can be produced, then that way it'll like kind of, which will never be equal, but I think it'll give more leverage to those languages.
We asked this question, this podcast is named Fulbright Forward. The intentionality there is that there is always more we can learn and unlearn and keep doing. From your perspective, what do you think about when I ask the question, like from your experience, what can we do to keep moving Fulbright forward?
First thing that I actually am talking to some Fulbrighters about right now is how can we as an alumni community come together to create initiatives, to create these spaces of dialogue, to continue talking about race and people of or Fulbrighters of color in the world and how to normalize the idea that Americans aren't white Americans. So that is something that we're actually pursuing as well. We're trying to really just talk to more Latinx Fulbrighters and start that like snowball effect. I also think that commissions could do a lot more by reaching out to their alumni and asking, like really understanding. Like I see this very much as in like my master's degree, where it's like, this is a research thing as well, right? Like there needs to be some sort of like needs assessment, monitoring and evaluation, and not so much like, great, we dropped you here, which is what a lot of development work is. We drop you here, you do what you have to do, you leave, goodbye, you're done. And that lack of follow through is really impeding a lot of growth, which a lot of the growth that we could be doing is very quick, right? Like we could literally just start these dialogues really quickly because there's so many of us and continue it. But I really think that commission should really reach out to their alumni and understand what happened in their experience, understand where are the gaps in learning, and have some action steps to continue growth in Fulbright. And the resources too, I know that like, where the resources are given to, who has what, and if more resources could be going to programs like yours where you're talking about diversity, that would be amazing, right? So like having these initiatives, I think I could help a lot. So definitely with backed up research. I'm a big researcher fan as well, Jeremy. So yeah.
And finally, like, is there anything you'd like to say just in closing out the episode? If there's something that you would want other folks interested in Fulbright, interested in international ed experiences that may share identity experience with you or not, just if there's anything in particular you would like to share with folks, and if there's an audience you have in mind who they are as we close out this episode.
Mm-hmm. I think my biggest learning takeaway is not to put more work and pressure on people of color, or especially Fulbrighters of color, especially alumni, but I think as much as we want for things to change, it's also kind of, I see it as my responsibility to talk to these first generation people or students of color. Because if my mentor had not been there for me, I would not have known about Fulbright. And I think it's very important for us to share our experiences and to just like have people know of Fulbright. Because I can tell you that if I go back to my small hometown in New Hampshire, and the people of color there have no idea what Fulbright is. Entonces, I think I would really like to see us alumni coming together and having these talks about our experience and opening more opportunities up for people who are like us. I think that will push more of this conversation, legit force it by having more Fulbrighters of color in the field, and these dialogues will inherently just come about.
Well, Maylin, thank you so much for your time. I know we've gone over than what we expected, but my hope is that it's been for you formative just in having space to reflect on certain things and also share really your brilliance around what I think bilingual education can be, the power of English, both as a precedent and potentially a place of growth. And I think for us to continue to think through how we move Fulbright forward. So thank you so much for all that you've shared about who you are, what you care about, and you know that you refuse to choose.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeremy.
And that's all for this episode of Fulbright Forward. Thank you so much for listening. For a list of resources mentioned in today's episode, you can go to the Fulbright Forward website hosted on our Buzzsprout page. Remember also that you can subscribe to Fulbright Forward through your favorite podcast app like Apple Podcasts or Spotify, as well as follow the podcast on Instagram. After recording this episode, I thought a lot about the story that Maylin shared when she and her co-teacher got her students dancing and singing to the song Color Esperanza. As Maylin notes, that moment shifted the dynamics of the classroom, and ultimately, it brought her students closer together, promoted learning, and allowed her Latinx students of color to be seen and heard in ways that may have only been felt by the white students prior. So I ask myself, and I ask listeners to think about this with me. What does that Color Esperanza moment look like in our work? What does it look like to shift the dynamics of power, privilege, and identity in our spaces in a way that welcomes discomfort and moves us towards more collective strength and community? Again, I'm Jeremy Gommon-Sperling, Fulbright America's Diversity Inclusion Liaison. Be well, stay safe, and until next time.